When someone is seriously ill, there are some things that we know can aid in recovery. We know about a healthy diet. We know about exercise. Now it looks like we can add faith to that list. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. A study published last year in Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing, found an 18% lower mortality rate for patients who had higher rates of spirituality or religiosity. Today, we'll explore the link between spirituality and physical well-being. I'll talk with Dr. Richard Deming about leading cancer survivors on epic physical and spiritual journeys, and we'll explore how patients and doctors can harness the power of this connection. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. A serious health crisis often shapes a person's faith. Sometimes faith is shaken. In other cases, it grows. Faith can also be an important component of healing. A study published last year in Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing, found an 18% lower mortality rate for patients who had higher rates of spirituality or religiosity. That's similar to the effect found among patients who eat a lot of fruits and vegetables or take statin drugs. This hour, we're going to explore the relationship between faith or spirituality and our physical health. With me now is Dr. Richard Deming. He is a radiation oncologist and the director of Mercy Cancer Center in Des Moines. He's also the founder of Above and Beyond Cancer and has traveled with cancer survivors around the world to do some amazing things, such as climbing Mount Everest and Mount Kilimanjaro. And this Saturday, the Above and Beyond Cancer bicycle team will set off from Oceanside, California in the Race Across America. Dr. Deming, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Charity, for having us.
Tell me a little bit about the Race Across America.
Well, the Race Across America is an amazing bicycle race that will take us from California to Annapolis, Maryland, 3,000 miles across 12 states. During the course of the ride, we'll climb 170,000 feet, the equivalent of climbing Mount Everest about six times. And we're doing it with a higher purpose. We're doing it as Above and Beyond Cancer, a group of cancer survivors and caregivers. And we're doing it to show that cancer does not have to limit what one can accomplish in life, and with a higher purpose to raise some awareness so that we can use our journey to help inspire others and also to do the work of ultimately trying to reduce the burden of cancer.
Obviously, as someone who works with cancer patients, it is your job to help them come back from cancer and come back into the world, recover their health. At what point did you link that to these amazing physical feats?
You know, I think that the answer to that is I've always recognized the role of vigorous physical activity as part of a healthy lifestyle, and I know that having cancer does not preclude the benefits. Cancer survivors, when they go through their cancer journey, I mean, they face incredible adversity. But through that adversity, they find incredible personal growth. And adversity often leads to personal growth, no matter what the adversity is. When a cancer survivor gets through their journey, they're often come out the other end with a greater sense of gratitude for the opportunity to live life authentically, full of passion and compassion, and to reach for something that is perhaps beyond what they think they can grasp. And it's only by reaching for something that is beyond what you know you can accomplish that you determine any sense of what you really can accomplish. And in April of 2011, took a group of cancer survivors to Everest Base Camp, where we rendezvoused with Charlie Whitmack, who was completing his world triathlon, and he went on to summit Mount Everest. But we went on this journey with a group that were not athletes, that had never had climbing a mountain as part of their bucket list, but chose to do this adventure as a mind-body-spirit journey. And whenever you journey, especially in the mountains, there's always a spiritual dimension to one's journey. Part of it is this sense of gratitude at having been given a chance at life again. And part of it is being in a simple existence where all your worldly possessions mean nothing to you when you're out in the mountains. And you're there living a simple life, traveling and walking and journeying together. And you see that there are people that live life differently, more simply, have different thoughts. And if you're the least bit curious and introspective, you wonder whether maybe the way you've always done everything certainly isn't the only way, and maybe isn't even the best way. And you're given the opportunity to see the face of the divine in different ways than you might have learned. And it just helps you ponder the question of meaning and purpose and our role on Earth.
What relationship do you think that has to physical health?
You absolutely cannot separate, mind, body, spirit. And we've come a long way in the technical aspect of treating various diseases. I'm a cancer doctor. I'm a radiation oncologist. I have incredible technology that allows me to treat tumors. But ultimately, I don't see myself as a tumor treater. I care for patients and families who have cancer. And what started off for me is a career in medicine and a career in cancer medicine really has become more of a ministry of healing. When you're dealing with healing someone as opposed to treating someone, you have to take into account not just the physical dimension, but also the emotional and philosophical and spiritual dimension of life, because it all comes together.
I want to bring into the conversation now Brandon Sickler. He lives in Des Moines. He is a cancer survivor. And Brandon, you'll be participating in this race across America on bicycles. You have also participated in Above and Beyond Cancer Treks to Everest and Kilimanjaro, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Let's talk a little bit about your cancer journey. First, you were diagnosed with leukemia when you were only 20 years old?
That is correct.
Tell me about the process that you went through from that point.
I guess my treatment, I was diagnosed May 8th, 2003, with a good family physician of ours who called both my parents into the clinic with me to tell us my diagnosis. He had set me up with a bone marrow biopsy the following day, and then that as soon as we got the bone marrow biopsy confirmed, I drove 8 hours over to Rochester, Minnesota, and I was on chemotherapy within 48 hours. Then went through 3 rounds of chemotherapy, one round of full-body radiation, followed with a bone marrow transplant, which was my brother was my donor, and total duration on that was got out of the hospital December 18th, 2003.
All right. So it was 7 months or so of this in and out of the hospital and really being on the brink of death.
Yes.
Before you were diagnosed with leukemia, you were a very young man. Were you an active person?
I was a very active person. Going into the hospital, I tried to stay as active as possible. While I was in the hospital, I was able to get my doctors to approve bringing in my mountain bike, and we bought a stationary trainer. The nurses had to scrub it down and make sure it was nice and sterile for me. And at first, I was able to go pretty good on it, doing sit-ups and push-ups every day and riding my bike. Towards the end, that was kind of fading.
After you went through all of this, you must have been terribly physically depleted.
Yes, I had lost about 45 to 50 pounds, which I really didn't have to lose. And coming out of the hospital, I actually moved straight to Bozeman, Montana, and I just wanted to live life and trying to do so in the mountains. I got a season ski pass, which in hindsight probably didn't work out the best for me because I used it maybe four or five times because I just didn't have the energy to be able to ski really hard every day like that. But yeah, it was a long, long uphill road to get me back into shape. I'd go buy a gym membership, buy all my supplements, my protein powders and all that stuff, and get discouraged that I wasn't where I used to be and things like that. So it was difficult.
You must have struggled in so many ways. How did your relationship with your body change because of all of that?
For a while, I think I let cancer try and redefine me, that I wasn't going to be as active as a person anymore. I'd go try and go out for runs, and through the chemo and the radiation, just my knees really hurt. So I couldn't really go out for runs anymore. I didn't have the speed that I used to have. So it was very, very difficult, very discouraging. And then I ran into Above and Beyond.
Tell me about that. When you discovered this organization, what did you think?
We moved out here for my wife to go to school at Des Moines University, and we had heard about this Charlie Whitmack, this famous Iowan, doing this crazy world triathlon. And he came back and was giving a speech at Des Moines University. Janessa, my wife, she went to the lunch meeting. I was out working, so I was going to plan to go to the evening seminar. And she called with just this joyous excitement, being like, "Hey, they're taking a group of cancer survivors to the base camp of Mount Everest to meet up with Charlie Whitmack." And that just started getting my brain excited. So I went that night and went up afterwards to talk with Charlie Whitmack. And just at the very end, I was just like, "Oh, and by the way, I'm a cancer survivor. What are the chances?" And so he immediately got me connected with Dr. Deming, and thankfully and by the grace of God, I got to go. And through that, just me signing up, it took a huge mental turn for me where it no longer mattered if I was the fastest runner or the strongest person out there. It just mattered that I was able to do it, and I was going to have fun and live life to the fullest and just seize the day. And so about a year and a half ago is really where it made a huge turn for me.
I'm talking with Brandon Sickler. He's a cancer survivor who lives in Des Moines. Also with me, Dr. Richard Deming, the founder of Above and Beyond Cancer. The two of them are preparing for the Race Across America, a 3,000-mile bicycle race that begins on Saturday. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Today, we're exploring the link between spirituality and physical health. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're exploring the link between spirituality and our physical health. In a few minutes, I'll be talking with Diana Cates, a professor of religious ethics at the University of Iowa, and Dr. Loris Kaljan, director of the program in bioethics and humanities at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Right now, I'm talking with Dr. Richard Deming. He's the director of Mercy Cancer Center in Des Moines. He's also the founder of Above and Beyond Cancer. He's led cancer patients on treks to Mount Everest and Mount Kilimanjaro. This week, he and a team of cancer survivors are getting ready to participate in the Race Across America. It's a 3,000-mile bicycle race. It begins on Saturday. Brandon Sickler is a cancer survivor. He's one of the members of that team. He lives in Des Moines. And Brandon, before the break, we were talking about how becoming a part of the group that would climb to the base camp at Mount Everest gave you inspiration and motivation to get back in shape. Before that, you had really struggled to do that. When you were training for that Mount Everest journey, how was that different than the physical training you did before that you found to be so discouraging?
Kindred spirits, other survivors. I had never, like I said, I immediately moved out to Bozeman shortly thereafter. Then I headed off to Seattle where Janessa, my wife, was at the time. And so didn't really ever get associated with a group of cancer survivors to hear their stories. And I guess just that camaraderie, and like I said, that kindred spirit of, you know, we're doing something that's beyond ourselves. We're doing this for a greater cause, and it's going to be a great time. And then it just didn't matter that, like I said, it didn't matter that I was the fastest person. It didn't matter that I didn't have to look back anymore and be like, oh, well, I used to do this. It's like, no, I'm doing this, and I'm going to live up to it. And carpe diem, seize the day.
How would you describe your spiritual journey in going through all of this?
What a question. I definitely have faith in Christ, and it never wavered, discouraged at times, but definitely the emphasis on by his stripes you were healed run through my head all the time. So I never ever doubted that I wasn't going to make it through my cancer journey. I just knew it was a detour, a life lesson somehow. Not that he got me sick by any means, but that he would see me through and that I would have a full life still. Psalms 118:17 was, I think, one of my big verses going through all my treatments, which says, I shall not die but live, and I will declare the works of the Lord. So through that, I think that helped sustain me a lot. And then really coming in to the Above and Beyond group and the network, seeing survivors of all different types of cancer, all different ages, and some like never having the thought of going and summiting Kilimanjaro or climbing and trekking to the base camp of Mount Everest, and just seeing their diligence and their fervor, and they just inspired me. And so then my verse for them as I was training with them and going through them became Isaiah 50, verse 4, just saying that the Lord God has given me the tongue of the learned, that I should know how to speak a word in season to him who is weary. He awakens me morning by morning. So then it became, how can I, as they inspire me and encourage me in their efforts and diligence, how can I inspire them with words of encouragement, with just an upbeat, positive attitude, just relaying that life goes on and we're doing this and we can change and just be the best person we can.
Dr. Deming, as Brandon just said, there were are people there from all walks of life, different kinds of cancer, different age groups, different backgrounds physically, and I'm sure different backgrounds as far as faith and spirituality goes as well. Is that something that you encourage people to talk about as a group, their faith and their personal beliefs?
You know, it definitely we bring up the topic of meaning and purpose of life, and that is a springboard for discussing spirituality. Probably more spirituality than religion. We definitely have not only men and women, all ages, all walks of life, but all religions. We have Protestants, Catholics, Jews, atheists, Buddhists. On the trip to Kilimanjaro, there were Muslims in our group. There's always a spiritual dimension, and more than religion, it's talking about meaning and purpose. And I approach life from a very existential point of view, which is not a negative dress in black downer. It says that, you know, inherently we need to find our own meaning and purpose. And as someone who's traveled around the world, and I think back to the first time I was in Nepal, and I was in a Buddhist ceremony as an observer, and I had really no idea what words were being spoken or what the ritual was that was being conducted. But being in the presence of a ritual opens up the possibility, opens up the avenue for accepting some spiritual divine component to life. On the journey to Kilimanjaro, Brandon was one of the younger patients. We had a 72-year-old Catholic priest who had delayed his cancer treatment for recurrence of cancer to do this journey, brought along his vestments and his chalice, and said Mass for all of us, for the Catholics and Protestants and Jews and Muslims on the journey, gave us all sacrament of the sick and made it to the summit of Kilimanjaro. We had a 69-year-old gentleman with two artificial knees and an artificial hip, and he made it to the summit of Kilimanjaro, 19,000 feet. A 63-year-old farmer's wife who'd never hiked a day in her life, a year out from cancer treatment, made it to the summit of Kilimanjaro. People have no idea what they can accomplish. And on the journey to Kilimanjaro, having Father Frank along, even for those who were not Catholic, I think back when I was in the first Buddhist ceremony, you know, I didn't really understand the ritual, but I knew that I was in a ritual that recognized a concept of the divine. And I think having Father Frank along and saying Mass, even if you didn't know the ritual of the Mass, and even if you weren't a Christian, being in the presence of the recognition of the divine definitely was inspiring. And those sorts of events, and as I said earlier, just being in the mountains, in the presence of nature, you contemplate the role of the human being on Earth and our role with another dimension in life.
Well, Brandon, Dr. Deming's talking about meaning and purpose, and it sounds to me like when you signed on to do this first journey, that gave you meaning and purpose that you had been lacking in your struggle to recover from cancer. But once that journey is over, how did that change the meaning and purpose of your life?
Well, it definitely just catapulted me into my past, I guess, into getting back into shape. And we just became kindred spirits of let's work out, let's do this. And then at getting in preparation for Kilimanjaro, the same thing, we're working out and going to the gym and meeting up with people. And in that time, we're talking about doing the RAM. So we're training for the RAM and biking.
Race across America.
Thank you. And doing all of that. So it just really, it was like, okay, I'm supposed to be healthy. I need to live a life that's with rigorous exercise. And I want to be fit. I want to eat healthy. And then taking that on with all these other great people who have joined the team and have become family has really inspired me.
I just wanted to add, you know, Brandon wouldn't say this about himself, but he focused a bit on the physical dimension and how he changed. But I would tell you that everyone, when they come back, comes back with a spirit of generosity that is just so enhanced. And, you know, Brandon and his wife had it in spades before the trip, but Brandon and everyone, when we come back, there's this sense of compassion and generosity, and I see it all the time as Brandon and the other survivors and the others that were on the trip just reach out not only to their other teammates, but to everyone that they encounter with a greater sense of what can I do to help you? How can I serve others? And, you know, that's something that Brandon would be too shy to comment on himself.
The Race Across America starts on Saturday. What have you been doing to prepare for this 3,000 miles?
Well, we've had a couple of different components to our physical workout for the last 9 months. We've been working with a trainer for strength training and doing indoor cycling during the winter. And then obviously when summer months arrive, we've been out on our bicycle. We did a trip to Utah to get a little chance to cycle in the mountains. And we did a trip down to Alabama to participate in a race. And then 2 weekends ago, we rode 580 miles in 32 hours to help us get prepared for being on the saddle a long time, being a bit sleep deprived, and getting used to being in the car. So we're doing it, though, as an 8-person team. So only one person is riding at any particular time. And as we're riding across America, we'll probably be doing like 20-minute stints on the bike where one person will ride as fast as he can for 20 minutes, hand it off to the next person who'll ride as fast as he can for 20 minutes and hand it off to the next person, and she'll ride as fast as she can. So we'll be frequently getting on and off the bike. We have a water bottle project that the listeners can participate in. When we journey to the tops of mountains, we carry with us prayer flags, where each flag is in honor or tribute to someone who has either lost their life to cancer or is affected by cancer but can't go on the journey. And then we fly the flags at the tops of the mountains. On the Race Across America, we have a water bottle project, and people are making, decorating water bottles in memory of someone who's lost their life to cancer or in tribute to someone who is dealing with cancer. And we will use those water bottles as we ride across America, and each water bottle will provide the rider not only sustenance but inspiration as we pedal 3,000 miles from coast to coast.
Well, best of luck to you, Dr. Deming. Thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
And Brandon Sickler, good luck to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the time.
Dr. Richard Deming is the founder of Above and Beyond Cancer. Brandon Sickler is a cancer survivor. Both of them will be participating in the Race Across America, a 3,000-mile bicycle race that begins on Saturday. If you'd like to wish the team well, there is a community picnic and bicycle ride at Waterworks Park in Des Moines tonight from 5:30 to 7:30. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, and today we're exploring the link between spirituality and physical well-being. And with me now is Diana Cates, Professor of Religious Ethics at the University of Iowa. Hello, Diana.
Good morning.
Also, Dr. Loris Kaljan, Director of the Program in Bioethics and Humanities at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Dr. Kaljan, thank you for being here today.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
The study that sparked this conversation today was published last year in Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing, and as I mentioned before, it showed an 18% lower mortality rate for patients who had higher rates of spirituality or religiosity, and in the study, they say that's a similar effect found among patients who eat lots of fruits and vegetables or take statin drugs. This is just one study, but the question of whether faith or spirituality impacts our health is one that people have been asking for a very long time. And Dr. Kaljan, I know that you think we should look at a study like this with some caution. Why is that?
I think we have to be very careful about what it is we think we're doing when we're talking about these kinds of associations between health and the way we measure health and something as profoundly important as spiritual beliefs or religious beliefs. And I think also a qualifier at the beginning of such a discussion has to be that we in our society are all coming from very different places in this regard. And so our beliefs about ourselves as physical beings, spiritual beings, our beliefs about the world and what works and doesn't work in the world, and our beliefs about God or whether God exists, all of this has to be on the table of discussion so that we don't misunderstand each other from the very beginning. I would also say that the study you're referring to, when I reviewed it in anticipation of this conversation, realized that it's actually a meta-analysis, but it's comparing different meta-analyses, which is a complicated way of saying that people are trying to look at the big picture of what a lot of different studies in different domains have shown. And their conviction is that the authors of the study are saying that, you know, spirituality may be as good for you in terms of the likelihood of your dying prematurely as fruits and vegetables or something like taking cholesterol-lowering medicines. Now, at the very beginning of such a comment, many people will say, what in the world are we talking about? Why are we comparing faith in God, for instance, and going to church with eating vegetables? And so I think we really have to be straightforward about how different these categories for some people are and yet still be curious about the possibility that certain things may actually have health benefits.
Well, just talking about spirituality or religiosity in this capacity brings up a lot of interesting problems because it's impossible to quantify something that is so immaterial. So studying the effect of spirituality poses some incredible challenges.
It does, but it is remarkable how investigators can actually put their minds and their resources to all sorts of questions in very pragmatic ways. And so one of the studies that was being reviewed in this meta-analysis was a study of church attendance. And they simply said, let's compare people who attend church one time per week or more to all others, so less than once a week, and see what the mortality rates of those different populations are. And so as a question, that's an askable and answerable question. How to interpret what you find is a huge question. And one of the big questions methodologically is the issue of causality. It's one thing to find an association between two different things. It's another thing to say that A is causing B, as opposed to simply saying A and B travel together for some reason.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Dr. Loris Kaljan, director of the Program in Bioethics and Humanities at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. In a moment, I'll bring Diana Cates, professor of religious ethics at the University of Iowa, into this conversation. And you can join the conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This hour, we're exploring the relationship between spirituality and our physical well-being. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this hour we're exploring the link between spirituality and religiosity and our physical well-being. And with me in the studio today are Dr. Loris Kaljan. He's director of the Program in Bioethics and Humanities at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Also, Diana Cates is here. She's a professor of religious ethics at the University of Iowa. And just before the break, we were talking about the study that sparked this conversation and how it's possible in some ways to study the effect of spirituality, of religious involvement. And Diana, maybe you can help us define our terms a little bit here, because we've sort of been using faith and spirituality interchangeably, but they're not the same thing. So can you define for me, let's start with faith. Let's start with religion. Define for me religious faith.
Well, one thing to keep in mind is that people around the world define these terms very differently, of course, in different languages. And there's no one way to define them that we can all agree on. One of the biggest debates within religious studies is what is religion and what is it to study religion? But I tend to think myself of religion and spirituality as much the same thing. I think of them as a way of thinking, feeling, and acting in relation to what we regard as sacred, or a way of connecting to what we think is the highest reality or what's ultimately real and true. But as I was listening to the earlier interview with Dr. Deming, I was really fascinated by the definition of religion and spirituality that came out in his discussion. I heard him saying that religion and spirituality really are a journey toward greater meaning and purpose. Now, what we tend to do is think of religion as being a historical tradition. We think of it as being an organization. We might think of it as having social, political, economic dimensions. We think of people joining a community where the community is defined by a story, and they live inside that story. And part of the way they do that is through the performance of rituals and gathering together at regular intervals to perform those rituals. And I think we tend to separate out spirituality from that. I would just caution people. I think that there are lots of people who do all those things and regard themselves as deeply spiritual. I think part of the reason why we've started to separate those out is because some people have been unsatisfied with religions that they've participated in. They don't find the stories compelling, or they find aspects of the tradition oppressive, or in some other way they feel like they're not finding the truth inside that tradition, and so they step away. So that means that they still have that same longing to figure out their meaning and purpose in life, but they haven't been able to do it inside a tradition, so they try to do it in more individual ways and often finding like-minded individuals, and so gathering together in smaller groups. But there are still going to be ways in which people tell stories and perform rituals, because that's just what humans do in order to find meaning and place themselves meaningfully inside larger stories.
But to be a person who is spiritual, who has a high level of spirituality, you don't need to believe in God, is what I'm hearing you say there.
Well, we'd have to ask ourselves what we mean by God. The problem for the study of religion is that there are lots of people who don't believe in God but participate in religions such as Buddhism, or they don't believe in God but regard themselves as being deeply spiritual. And the problem, I think, is that certain traditions, such as the monotheistic traditions, have had such power in defining the concept of God that lots of people look at that concept and they think, I don't believe that. That can't be right. That doesn't mean anything to me. And yet they still have this deep religious impulse, is what I call it, a deep longing to connect with something greater than themselves or deeper or something more true than they encounter in their ordinary daily life. So, you know, if you think of God very abstractly as the creative principle of reality, or you think of God as perfect goodness or the power of love or anything like that, but you don't associate God with maleness or with particular character traits or, you know, things that tend to be associated with more monotheistic traditions, well, then, you know, you're believing in God, but maybe other people wouldn't call that God.
Dr. Calgin, before the break, we were talking about how you can look at particular factors of a person's spirituality and look at how that relates to their physical well-being. And you, one of them that you pointed out in one of the studies that was brought together to do this analysis was that, you know, just attendance at a church, going to church once a week or more. What do we know about how engaging in these religious rituals affects our well-being?
I don't think we know that much about it, really. And in fact, the authors of the study that you mentioned earlier on admit in that article as a limitation that there's actually no evidence, for instance, that changing your religious service attendance or behaviors actually improves your health. So they're simply taking a cross-sectional one-moment look in time and saying people who do this have these characteristics. They don't say, and then people decided to increase their church attendance and lo and behold, look what happened. And so people don't know that. So I think we have to be very cautious about those kinds of considerations on the scientific realm. And so good science needs to be done well by well-trained scientists, social scientists or otherwise. My actual concern, though, in this regard is actually on a theological basis, which is to say that I think there's a tendency in some of these discussions to start treating religious belief or spirituality as if it's an instrument or a tool to be used like aspirin or something else that I can pull off the shelf.
Or prescribing a healthier diet or exercise, that kind of thing.
That's right. That's right. And I, my concern here is that there, for some of us at any rate, who come from our particular frameworks of belief here, we have a sense of the ordering of goods in life. And there are greatest and greater goods and lesser goods. And this kind of a conversation can sometimes lead some of us to wonder whether people are reversing the order and getting the cart in front of the horse. And so I think that has to be something that we take seriously. For instance, let's say that you had, by comparison, a study that said that people who are married are less likely to be depressed. Well, if I'm caring for a single person who's depressed, should I recommend to that person, now, you really need to find a spouse? People would look at me as if I was really getting something disordered there in my priorities. So I think we have to remind ourselves intrinsically what is the value of the thing, especially things of ultimate purpose and meaning in our lives.
Diana, in talking about religious rituals, let's talk about some of the things about participating in a religion that might be beneficial to our health, like the sense of community.
Right. Well, yeah, I'd like to even start with church attendance. If you think about, first of all, these studies have primarily been done on Christians and Christian church attendance, so that doesn't necessarily mean that we can draw conclusions about other people and their forms of worship. But if you think about attendance at a Christian church. Yes, you have a community that you feel a part of. There's a sense in which everybody knows that everybody else is there for everyone else. You've witnessed it over the years. You've seen people get sick and the rest of the community come to their aid, and you've participated in coming to other people's aid. And so there's a sense in which you really belong to something deep and lasting. And I think that can really reduce worry and stress, especially in older people who feel like they might be alone or abandoned in their old age. And also, there's things like taking time away from busyness and work-related mode. And there is something like meditation going on in church. But beyond that, there's conversation and there's laughing. We know from lots of studies that laughter is really good for your health, especially belly laughs. And so all of these things are going on. And singing, I think singing has to be really good for your health. So even though, you know, I think it's also true that some people believe that God is present in church. And so we're always looking for kind of materialistic scientific explanations of what's going on. But lots of religious believers think that there's also something deeper spiritual going on that we can't analyze in quite these terms.
We've talked about the search for meaning and purpose being part of spirituality, being part of a religious faith. There are other domains of these spiritual needs. And Dr. Calgin, you've looked deeply into those. What else is there?
Well, in the reading and discussing I've done over the years when thinking about the practice of medicine and medical ethics, I've appreciated those who might categorize spiritual needs generally in four different groups. And we've already heard a lot of discussion of the first one, and that's the need, the basic need we have as human beings for meaning and purpose in our lives. The second would be the need for hope. The third would be the need for, some would call it forgiveness. Others would use the word reconciliation. And I think reconciliation can be meaningful at various levels. And then the third, for those who believe in God or a transcendent being or creator, that would be the fourth. And I think these are strikingly important categories, especially when one is thinking, for instance, of the possibility of being healthy even when one, for instance, is dying. And what does hope look like for someone who may be dying? We heard wonderful stories about cancer survivors, but we also heard references to remembering those who have not survived. And so what do these categories mean for us when we are in our most difficult moments and are in need of that support, that faith, the very deepest things that allow us to go forward in great adversity?
There are certain situations in which a patient seems to be more likely to turn to faith for support. You just mentioned one of those, the end of life. This is a time when a lot of people are really searching for that meaning or purpose and reflecting on their lives. Another time is when people are suffering and struggling with substance abuse and or depression. And when we look at support groups and 12-step programs, faith seems to be an important part of those kinds of treatments.
I completely agree. So the Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, program and the need for a higher power to basically admit your fundamental dependence on a being greater than yourself is profoundly important. And in an earlier time in Connecticut, I worked part-time as a doctor in the state prison system, working with HIV-positive patients. And these are people who had, shall we say, had great struggles in life. And for many of them, their deepest needs were actually more spiritual in their categorization in their own minds than they were medical. And so I think substance abuse and issues of depression, especially when you think of depression as hopelessness, is often a key feature of that. So how can the need for hope be addressed by professionals and family members, church communities, et cetera, for such a person who's liable to be suffering in that way?
Not everyone is a believer, though. I mean, there are many people who struggle with substance abuse or struggle with depression who do not believe in God, who are not members of religious communities. And this is the big question. What can we take away from what we've learned from these studies and what we've observed from people who are spiritual and who are engaging in these religious communities? How can we use that? How can we implement that with people who don't naturally go that direction?
You know, I think one of the key issues here that we've already been touching on throughout this whole hour is a different way of looking at human beings and what we might call a patient-centered and whole person way, where our physical and spiritual selves are not to be bifurcated or separated, but to actually be seen as integrated and intimately related to each other. And so I would encourage patients and their family members, when engaging with healthcare providers, to not be content with just looking at numbers and scan results and whatnot, but to remind each other that we are whole persons and we have a spiritual dimension. Some will recognize that and define it in religiously described terms. Others won't. But I would certainly support the position that says we're all in the same boat, whether or not we see things the same way.
We have an email from Nick in Iowa City. He says, I'm compatible with the thesis that faith and spirituality could be good for your health and life expectancy. However, I'm also curious with regard to what it is about them. Of course, we've been talking about that. But he says, is it possible that it's just the capacity to relax or cast off cares, to meditate or contemplate? Diana?
Yeah, I think that is a good part of it. There are also studies that have been done specifically on different forms of meditation that have shown some similar results. But of course, as Dr. Kaljan has pointed out, those studies too are regarded as problematic from a scientific point of view. I wanted to think a little bit more about the question that you just asked, which is, how can we use this information that we have? And this takes me back to Dr. Kaljan's comment about treating religion or spirituality as a mere tool. I think that's a really important point for us to take away. And part of what that means for me is that what we can do with it is start asking really good questions. Before we look for answers, we have to first be really asking the question authentically. We have to be curious about why we're here, if there's any reason at all. And when bad things happen to us, we have to allow ourselves to ask that question, how could this happen to me? There are lots of people now, for example, around the life situation of Amy Copeland, the young woman in Georgia who has the quote-unquote flesh-eating bacteria. Her family is deeply committed to this belief that she has a purpose, and she got this flesh-eating virus or bacteria, sorry, and has lost limbs because God wanted her somehow to play a specific role in God's creative process. So, amazing.
So it sounds like you're bringing us full circle here in some ways, because we were talking at the beginning of the show with Dr. Deming about journeys, both physical journeys and spiritual journeys. And it sounds like you're saying, Diana, that in many ways the power can be found in the journey, in the questioning.
Absolutely. I think the questions are way more important than the answers, partly because if one does believe in God, one generally believes that God is the infinite, and one can't ever capture the infinite in finite human language. So all religious traditions or systems are by nature limited. So they can point to something, but it's something that we can't finally wrap our minds around.
Diana Cates, thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Diana Cates is a professor of religious ethics at the University of Iowa. And Dr. Loris Kaljan, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Loris Kaljan is director of the program in bioethics and humanities at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Catherine Perkins, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan, with technical support from Clay Masters in Des Moines. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, it's Wildlife Day with Jim Pease. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.